This is Tammy Simon of Sounds True. We are delighted to partner with Raphael Kushner on the series Teaching What We Need to Learn. We at Sounds True recognize the value of leading with vulnerability and heartful authenticity on the spiritual journey, and we hope you find this series a significant contribution to that goal.
Welcome to another episode of Teaching What We Need to Learn. I'm your host, Raphael Kushner. In this series, I invite renowned teachers from many different perspectives and traditions to take a deep personal dive, to share with listeners in a way that brings us all closer together. I invite you to listen from your heart, opening fully to whatever speaks to you in the here and now. I also invite you to notice when you become curious to learn more, as well as when you're triggered, challenged, or called to share with the listening community. From the page at which you've accessed this recording, you can also click over to the Discuss section. That's where you can engage with one another about the themes of this series in a safe, honoring, mutually supportive way. Where it feels helpful, I'll join the discussion too. My guest in this installment of the series is mindfulness leader, psychiatrist, and neuroscience visionary, Dr. Daniel Siegel. I'm humbled and honored to say that Dan took this series to a very tender, profound, and moving place. As we did our initial mind, body, emotion, spirit check-ins to begin the dialogue, Dan shared about the very recent death of his father. It was the first I'd heard of it, which meant that Dan and I traveled completely unscripted into very vulnerable territory. I learned so much, and hope you will too. To learn more about the very special way Dan meets each moment and challenge on his personal journey, visit drdansiegel.com. That's drdansiegel.com. And now, please do your own mind, body, emotion, spirit check-in, and then enjoy the interview.
Dr. Siegel, I'm so glad to have you with us today.
Raphael, great to be here. Thank you.
So I like to begin these conversations just by checking in to the present moment, and especially the sense of mind, body, emotion, spirit that's here for both of us. So we start from that place. And I just want to say that I'm feeling, first of all, really excited to be talking to you today, little nervous, and also I have a little rush in my system because I wasn't sure I had the right phone number or way to reach you, and I had a session with a client that went over and ended just before we started talking. So I'm sure in a moment some of that will settle, but right now there's a kind of a little wind up in my system, and that's how I'm starting. Mm-hmm. So let me just check in with you. What are you noticing in your own experience?
Well, you know, I'm very honored to be here with you and looking forward to the talk. You know, I've had a recent huge change in my life where my father passed away last week, and so I'm continuing the work. You know, it's been, he was ill for 18 months, and so it wasn't a surprise that he would pass away, but it was, of course, whenever it happens, it's painful, and this has been really a period of deep reflection and transition and sadness for my whole family and myself. So you may hear in my voice a little less chipperness, and, you know, we are where we are, and I debated whether to put off our doing the interview, but I thought, you know, if the topic that you're exploring, Raphael, is being present with what is, I thought, then I will be present with this experience, but acknowledging it and naming it can sometimes help, make sense of it and be present with it. So that's where I am.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm really grateful that you shared that, and of course, somehow it would enter into the field of our conversation if you didn't name it, and maybe not with as much fullness and beauty, really, and delicacy. So it's wonderful, and just so that, you know, the people listening know, this is something that I didn't even know about until this very moment. So I'm touched, and I really want to honor the space that you're in terms of the grieving process. And so rather than starting in some other direction, I would love, if it feels right to you, and if it doesn't feel too you know, raw or personal, just to ask you how you are meeting this passage. You have many tools and lots of life experience around presence and around bringing mindfulness to any situation. And then there are these moments that are bigger than we can ever really predict or imagine. So, so you know, how is it for you and how are you approaching it?
Well, I mean, it's the the starting place is, you know, from the inner subjective reality of just feeling, you know, the loss of that sadness doesn't even describe it. It's more like, you know, a pounding pain of sometimes disorientation, sometimes just a longing, sometimes a sadness, sometimes a feeling of shock and disbelief at this moment. And so just being with all of that, and I have, you know, fantastic family members who, in going through the same thing, we can share that with each other. So that's been a part of this past week together like that. And then friends, you know, being with people who care and who have been on this journey. My father's been very, very ill for a year and a half, so it's been a kind of, we thought he was going to die about a year and a half ago, so it's been this extended grieving for my mother and for my brother and for our wives and our kids and everyone. He was so ill. So that the friends who knew about that, it's also been very supportive. So in the place where it's at, it's a lesson just to get a little conceptual on, you know, how our minds are not just encased in these skins, that we live within these mind webs of social connections that are the source of love and nurturance, you know, that as this grief unfolds, it's so clear that it's not just my grief, it's a transition of our entire family, and the mind sort of plays out these experiences that link all of us who are going through this period of not only loss but adjustment. It's kind of a, I feel like it's a, I have this kind of a revolving, in the old days you say a carousel for those people who understand what slides used to be, but now it's a, like a revolving photo file and with videos and audio clips and still images of my father and my family and myself. And so I had to, you know, I have to measure it out from a personal point of view. I give myself lots of space. I went for a long, long walk this morning with my dogs, and just giving my space to let, giving me the space to let my mind kind of sort through things in a very aware but not directed way, a kind of open, receptive, flowing process. So that's been really useful. And then I have to really be careful with the clients I see, the patients I see, you know, when I can see them or not, and who I disclose this to and not, who I think can needs to know, and who, you know, maybe it's overwhelming for them to know, and I don't think the kind of interactions we have will necessitate me speaking about it. But for some people, it really has been helpful to say this is what's going on. And, you know, so it's a lot of stuff. And if I thought that I wouldn't be able to be present with you, Raphael, I would have canceled this or postponed it for another time. But I really felt like I was up to the task, and certainly I felt like you could say, hey, this isn't appropriate, let's put this off. So, but you can always say that to me. You know?
Well, no, as a matter of fact, I think that one of the fundamental principles of the work that I do with people around emotional connection, and that I suspect, even though I haven't talked with you about it directly, that you would also subscribe to, is the idea that we can only really work with what's present, and we can't you know, a client or a colleague can't come and say, well, this is all that's going on with me right now. This is what's filling up my being and my consciousness. But what I really want to work on is that.
Yeah, exactly.
So I trust, actually, that what is going to happen in our conversation, and I would actually say what is already happening, is just right and deeper even than it could have been or would have been if there wasn't this, you know, in the field. So it feels like this is exactly what's meant to be happening. And
well, that's good. I mean, I'm glad we're checking it out with each other. It's so interesting to rest in a space of kind of, I don't know what the word is, but like acceptance or letting it happen or not feeling like you have to control it or something like that, where in this case, you know, with the death of my father, the thing that has been so surprising has been that there's a kind of reorganization, a sorting through inside of me that I never would have expected. I thought, well, it'll be sad and it'll be lonely and it'll be an adjustment, but it's almost been like this reshaping of who I am. It's kind of, I don't even know, it's so raw and so new, I can't really put words to it, but it's something that's kind of surprising for me. And in terms of the issue of like what the mind is, you know, and for me in the last 20 years, you know, I've been wrestling with these maybe unanswerable questions, but like, what is the mind, and, you know, how do relationships affect the mind, and what does the brain have to do with it, that kind of thing, and the whole body. And I can feel in my body this participation in some relational reality that sweeps my body up into, you know, sometimes crying, sometimes just clarity, sometimes confusion. And I just let it happen, and I'm, you know, part of me is really intrigued by it. A part of me is, I wouldn't say distressed, but a part of me is aware it is disorganizing, and I kind of let my more observing mind, you know, we have these two circuits, an observing circuit in the brain and an experiencing circuit. I kind of let my observing circuit, which narrates kind of the unfolding story as it's happening, I let this observing narrating circuit say, hey, you have just lost your father. You need to allow the experiencing you to just do whatever it's going to do. And don't overlay, you know, expectations or requirements or, you know, the shoulds of life onto it. Just let it happen. And it's been just really fascinating to take that stance, because things are happening inside of me, and I'm writing a lot about it, that I'm just kind of like shocked at this, the resorting, and how profound and pervasive it is. It's just incredible. So,
Well, you know, there's in what you're describing, there are some of the great themes of your work and of your really special contribution, because one of the things you mentioned was that the experience was unfolding between self and loved ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, you created something that you call interpersonal neurobiology, or synthesized, let's say. And part of that is a sense that the autonomous self that is, you know, maybe part of the Western and even especially the American tradition, the, you know, a man is an island, I'll pull myself up by my bootstraps, is an illusion in a deep and sometimes painful sense, and that we come to a greater fullness and peace in recognizing that who we are is as much between ourselves and others as it is within.
Absolutely.
And so that's one piece that you're relying on and opening to, as you described it. So really the heart of your work is right there in that process that's unfolding.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said, and I, you know, of course, it's, you know, the way we filter things, whether you think about the brain or the mind or relationships or three aspects of one reality, this filtering process of our human experience you know, it could be that, well, okay, so I've thought about this stuff, whatever, synthesized things, interpersonal neurobiology is how I kind of not only see things professionally, but how I live my day-to-day life. So it's not just some intellectual exercise. To me, it's like the bedrock of, like, trying to create well-being inside of myself personally, as we're talking about now in terms of this grieving process, but also, you know, professionally, how I see things. So it could be that I'm just distorting everything through the lens of this thing. And in fact, you know, the mind can do that. It can, you know, it can turn perceptions in a certain direction based on what we believe. So I'm not trying to give this to you, Raphael, or anyone listening to this as like research evidence or experimental data, but it is, you know, observational information that to me makes a lot of sense. And so I wouldn't try to put like statistics to what I'm saying, but it is the experience. And I think when I allow myself to just say, well, it could all be distorted by your own perceptual beliefs, so, you know, don't be categorizing it, it has a quality of just permitting things to unfold, and they make sense. Like, for example, the concept of integration, you know, linking differentiated parts. I find these twirls of images of audio things of my father and of me, and, you know, video things I see and still photographs literally in my head or wherever it is, you know, in my mental life that I see, you know, it is a kind of linking these differentiated parts of my childhood, my adolescence, my adulthood, things that have happened over the last year and a half, which were kind of profound in many ways, and the shift of generations, becoming, you know, one of the senior males in my family, so that there's a whole, I think of myself as 17, but now I'm like the old dude, you know, so it's like, it's very, the whole thing as a member of a relational mind has a kind of quality of, you know, that you don't own your mind, you know, that you don't, you know, I think it's an understandable point of view of certain sciences that the mind emanates from the brain. I mean, we can understand why you might think that way. And it's easier to do experiments, of course, because then you stick a person's body in a scanner and you see what's happening in the brain. You say, oh, there's the mind. But that view really doesn't embrace, I think, what a lot of studies suggest, and certainly this grieving process reveals, which is that, you know, the mind is not just encased by the skin, and it's certainly not limited to the skull. It's this larger relational process in addition to being an embodied process. So as these generations unfold, you know, we all face death, and we are part of a network. We're embedded in these social connections, and, you know, we become the next generation if we're lucky, and, you know, and life unfolds, and we don't have that much time. We have about a century, you know, and it gives a preciousness to everything that I think when someone dies, it heightens that deep, and I call it temporal integration, but this deep sense, existential sense of, you know, how crucial our attitude toward life is to bringing a fullness to it, even in the face of knowledge about death.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the aspect of being in relation to is really coming through very strongly in what you're sharing, and I just want to kind of go with that for a moment. You talked about the observing and the experiencing, and in the Hindu tradition, you may be familiar with, there are the two great forces of existence. There's Shakti, the energy of that which arises, and then there's Shiva, that which beholds what arises.
Wow.
And what it's said in that tradition that when Shiva and Shakti are in indivisible and exquisite union, that is enlightenment.
Wow. Well, I've never heard that before, but that's beautifully said. And what it's fascinating because, you know, that would be a good example from a consilient point of view. Consilience is, you know, finding independent pursuits of knowledge and truth and trying to find the universal principles. So that would be an example of integration, you know, taking differentiated, was it Shakti and what was the other one?
Shiva.
And Shiva, you know, taking these differentiated ways of knowing, experiencing and beholding, and linking them in this sense that's called indivisible. But I would ask you, does that philosophy also speak about while they may become indivisible, they need to maintain their own unique integrity as differentiated parts?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and since I'm not either a Hindu or a Hindu scholar, I want to have a certain don't know about that, and mm-hmm. you know, maybe some listeners can you know, write to me on our site about that when they hear this. But what I do want to say about it, that I do feel on you know, firmer ground to discuss, is that the allowing that is necessary for that union to occur is really the relational piece we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, in the work that I do with people in connecting to their emotions, I use the metaphor of surfing to help them understand what it is they're meant to do. And the idea is that your emotions are in your body. That's the only place they arise, move, shift, depart. And they are waves moving through you akin to waves in the ocean. And that you, in order to get the full message of the emotion, which is the sensation, I don't mean like the insight that might come later or the understanding or meaning, but to get the message of the emotion that we need in order to be in harmony with ourselves requires that we stay in awareness from an allowing and non-controlling perspective long enough for our, especially if it's a difficult emotion, to come back into fuller presence, to release a contraction, to feel more expanded into the moment that we're living.
Mm.
And we can't do that if we think somehow that we know what is supposed to happen or that we are choosing consciously or unconsciously to avoid what's happening within us. So my work is about the inner relationship. And then that, of course, extends to the we that you write and speak about a lot. So with Shiva and Shakti, awareness, experience, it's a sustained connection and then a willingness to be with the flow that results. That's where all the magic is from my experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. And, you know, that's... in the mindful brain, you know, I suggest that these fascinating overlaps in findings in relational science, especially the science of attachment of love between a parent and a child, we use the term attunement, and in particular it's an interpersonal attunement where, you know, a caregiver, attachment figure like a parent, tunes into the internal experience of a child and accepts it without shoulds and expectations and judgments, but just is present literally with this fullness of receptivity and openness to take in not just the behavior of the child, but the signals from that behavior that reveal the inner life of the child. It's called attunement, and it's really the basis of healthy parent-child relationships, but also probably relationships of all sorts. In mindfulness, for me, as a new, you know, construct, very new, you know, and my immersion in it was done as an attachment researcher and someone working in this interpersonal stuff. It seemed to me that it was a very similar process when I was taught mindfulness meditation, and that there was indeed this attunement internally, which would have been an observing self, just like an attachment figure, in a kindly, open, receptive, non-judgmental, fully present way, attuning to an experiencing self. What's fascinating was I published that, I guess it was like April of 2007. In December of 2007, the first scientific data came out to show, in fact, that I guess what's been in wisdom traditions for a while and for me just felt intuitively what was happening in my own experience, from a subjective reflective point of view. But then there was research evidence that came out in December of 2007 from the lab of Norman Farb and colleagues in Toronto that, in fact, there were two different circuits in the brain, that one was an experiencing circuit that's more toward the sides, on both sides of the brain, and the other is the observing, narrating circuit, a kind of internal witness, if you will, the beholder, that's more centrally located, and that this differentiation of the two circuits, observing and experiencing, for me, when I discussed the Farb paper, this is in the Journal of Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience in December of 07, when they asked me to do the discussion, what I said was, you know, the mindfulness-based stress reduction work that Farb and colleagues were studying was a beautiful example of integration of consciousness, that you were differentiating these two aspects of inner reality that have neural correlates, and then once you differentiate them, you link them, and that mindfulness wasn't just like losing yourself in the flow of something. It was actually honoring these two differentiated streams of awareness and then linking them. And, you know, that's different from what other people might interpret those results as saying. But for me, they were those research findings, those empirical brain science findings, were a beautiful example of how mindfulness is a way we integrate consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And there are some really, to me, significant themes in what you were just describing. So one of them is this paradox that in order to really fully connect to something, you have to be able to witness it.
Yeah.
And witnessing at first seems like it's standing apart. But without the witnessing or observing quality, as you're describing it, then you're just reacting. And you're not able to come together and, as you say, to integrate the experience as fully as possible.
Well, exactly. And, you know, that's parallel to another, the fun thing of consilience is, you know, you look for these different manifestations of principles across, you know, different ways of learning about truth. So there's some great studies on creativity and its connection to attention. And two sets of studies, and one I'll talk about studies of presence in a moment, but before I do that, let me talk about these studies of creativity. Basically, they showed that when you have like perseverance and are really approaching attention in a kind of stick-to-it kind of way, that's one part of the necessary list of ingredients that you need for creativity, for discovering new ways of thinking about things, whatever. But the other thing was you need to let yourself let go of very directed attention and have what some people would call daydreaming. Now, daydreaming is where you let your mind just kind of go in spontaneous ways, making new associations that don't have kind of necessarily a logical, rational way of attaining things. But what they found, which was absolutely fascinating, relevant to what you're saying, Raphael, is that the people who just daydream and don't know they're daydreaming have no increase in creativity. It's the people who can daydream to have the experience of new associations arising, but they have an observing self. This is literally what they talk about. They have an observing self that is observing that another part of themselves is daydreaming, and they kind of give that daydreaming circuit, if you will, the freedom to do it, but they don't lose track of the fact that they're intentionally daydreaming. And those are the people who use their daydreaming in a productive way to create new combinations, not people who just mind wander and get lost in something and don't even know they're lost in something. It's really interesting because it goes along with exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, that's just a fascinating explication of that. I love hearing that.
Isn't that amazing? And
yeah.
This is, you know, when you look at Alyssa Eppel and Elizabeth Blackburn and colleagues' work on telomeres. Telomeres are the ends of chromosomes that are maintained by an enzyme called telomerase, and Elizabeth Blackburn won the Nobel Prize recently for discovering the system, that we have this enzyme that she discovered, telomerase, telomere ACE, so ACE means an enzyme and telomere is the ends of chromosomes. So telomerase maintains the ends of chromosomes and even repairs them. An initial study showed that mindfulness meditation for some reason increases the enzyme that maintains the life of your and health of your ends of your chromosomes. Well, a new study that's just being submitted now for publication shows that presence, being aware of what you're doing when you're doing it, is likely the mediator of increased telomerase. Now, interestingly, in those studies, the way they measure presence is by they beep someone randomly and find out if they're aware of what they're doing when they're doing it. And mind wandering in these studies is the opposite of presence. Now, I'd have to see exactly the methodology of these presence studies versus the creativity studies, but I would bet you, and we'd have to look this up, that the presence that Alyssa Epple and colleagues are studying, where you're aware of what's going on as you're going on, precludes the idea that you've intentionally let yourself daydream, because then you'd be aware, I am daydreaming, that's what I want to be doing, and I'm doing it, versus the other folks who just mind wander aimlessly and don't even realize they're doing it when they could be doing something else that they're aware of. So it would be interesting to see that. But in this case, what the present study suggests is that this ability to actually monitor, even in an open way, what you're doing as you're doing it, directly relates to the health of your cells, because it increases telomerase, and which maintains the life of your cells. Literally can be younger by learning to be present in life. And so as we talk about even doing this interview, and I say, look, I'm trying to be present with my father's death and my feelings and what's going on in my family, and just trying to monitor when I should do things or not do things. You know, what I'm trying to do is really respect the presence from wisdom traditions, presence from neuroscience studies, and all these different ways that we can be present with what's going on, including what my neighbor is doing, moving his trash can. So let me close the window. We have this capacity to, just be there with what is as it's unfolding. And I think what I think my wife and I have tried to do with the grandkids during, this is their first loss in their life, is, you know, to model for them as best we can, you know, that you're present with whatever is arising, whatever feelings come up, whatever non-feelings come up, sadness or not sadness, or, you know, feeling like you can talk clearly, or, you know, even my father, when he was near death, and the last time I was with him, I mean, he said, you know, what's going on with me? What's going on with me? And I had to say to him, which at that moment, you know, no one had the opportunity to tell him. I told him he was dying, that his body was giving out and it was getting ready to be the end. So we sat there, I was holding his hand, and, you know, I, in myself, in my observing self, not just the painfully sad self that was experiencing the sadness, but my observing self, knew that all I could do in that unbelievably profound moment was just to be present with whatever was going on in me, whatever was going on in him, whatever was happening between us. And I held his hand, and it was this sense of clarity and strength and profound sadness, and also a kind of, in a strange way, a kind of just reality. I don't want to use the word joy, but a kind of a celebration of life that, you know, he and my mother gave birth to me, and we lived this long life. He was 89, and here I was holding his hand with this body now that's a little younger than his, not so much younger, but a little younger, that could articulate some things for him about what he asked me what he needed to do. And we talked about, what do you do when your body is giving out and your heart isn't functioning and your whole system is getting ready to shut down? And he was awake enough to have that conversation, you know, and to talk about how he didn't want to be alone, and that he wanted to know what to do. We talked about saying things to all the people in his life that he wanted to make sure he could say everything that he needed to say. And so he said some things to me, and I said some things to him. And, you know, it was really, it was one of those moments where you just say, wow, you know, just all we can do in life, no matter how the pain is there, no matter the helplessness you feel, is just be present. And so in that way, that whole background of knowledge about presence for me in that moment with my dad gave me a kind of inner strength and inner clarity so that in the between my dad and myself, I could be there for him. You know, I mean, later on after he died and I was in his room, you know, I was crying my head off and I couldn't have said anything like what I said. I just let myself be consumed with the sadness of everything. And but there are moments when we need to be present and clear for other people when they're hurting a lot, and then give ourselves permission to, you know, I guess I would say, I mean, I can use the phrase fall apart, but it's really fall together, you know, in some ways, you know, when we let ourselves disassemble and not be rational and not, you know, have it all together, but just rather to give ourselves permission to just sort through things.
Well, you know, the observing, the witnessing that you were speaking about and that I was talking about a little bit earlier, my sense is that it's not a rational or irrational function. It includes all of that. And so just like one can be aware that one is daydreaming, you know, one can also be aware that one is falling apart or falling together, as you describe it, and hold that. And it brings me back to the term that you used earlier, attunement, and you spoke about it in terms of parent-child connection, which I really deeply value, that how that concept works. And I love the work that you did in the book, The Whole Brain Child. I think it's one of your most recent publications.
Yes.
About that. And really what we're talking about is attunement within and attunement between.
Yeah.
And my sense is that attunement is the healer. That if we think of healing not as fixing something that's broken, but about either restoring or deepening wholeness, that it is the art and the practice of attunement, which is always it. And
right.
You described it, you know, as you were with your father in those most moving and powerful moments, you know, at the end of his life, and then also with yourself after that passage had occurred and there you were on your own. And I think the value of attunement is just inestimable. It's really,
yeah,
in a way, what life is about.
I think so, you know, and to, you know, to see the internal attunement of mindfulness as a way the kind of observing, narrating self is open and receptive to an experiencing, sensing self, you know, is a really, for me, you know, way of linking it to the between attunement, the interpersonal attunement, and they have the same outcomes when you look at the research, but in the experience, these are profoundly integrative in the sense that you allow a differentiated entity, whether it's an observing self or a parent, to be open and connecting to another entity, in this case, you know, an experiencing self or the child. And that attunement creates this massively integrated state, and this linkage of differentiated parts is a whole other thing we can talk about. But, you know, the journey of life is never, you know, you don't reach like some fixed place. And I got to say, you know, when you look at the mind as this both embodied and socially embedded, you know, process, a relational process as well as an embodied process, you can see that this, what we say in the interpersonal neurobiology, is its mind is not just awareness and non-awareness, but also subjective experience. And this third process called self-organization, and the self-organization of mind is not limited to the skin. That when I was with my dad and we were being with each other, I was holding his hand, we were talking about what one does when the organs of one's body, his body, were so old and so weak that they couldn't give him the nutrients, the oxygen, the blood flow, literally, that he needed. And you know, month by month, week by week, now day by day, and then hour by hour, it was getting to the turning point where it would no longer sustain life. You know, and none of us live forever, you know, so it's like, here we were, a father and son, holding hands, our observing selves together, attuning to each other, saying, wow, the experiencing here is that the body in this life we live as animals and as humans, the body does not go on forever, you know. And it is a moment of clarity in both our minds, you know, that we can see that this is something the mind depends on. The mind needs a body in which to have this embodied mechanism where energy and information is flowing. And I didn't say all this stuff to him, but this is what I was thinking when I said, you know, your mind is getting challenged because your body isn't having the energy it needs. And he was very frightened, you know, and he said so, and I shared with him something, which I'll share with you now, Raphael, but, you know, people can take it however you want to take it. But I said to him, I said, Dad, you know, I've never had someone come to me as a patient saying they were terrified of where they were before they were conceived. I said, so, you know, because my father doesn't have a religious background, you know, and so it's kind of frightening for an engineer scientist to face, you know, well, he doesn't have like a story in his mind about what's going to happen. So I said to him, I said, you know, whatever your beliefs are, I said to him, I said, think about it this way. You're going to the exact kind of place, very likely, where you were before you were conceived. And no patients have ever gotten to be frightened of where they were before they were conceived. And if you're going to that same place, which is really a place of infinite possibility, you know, of total openness, of resting in that spacious potential, I said, and that may be where we all go in these bodies, which give us this fixed century of experience, limited by what we can do with the bodies and our imagination, but, you know, you may be going to a place of infinite openness like that. And he looked very peaceful. He said, thank you. He said, that makes me feel comfortable. Mm. And, you know, I feel that way. I don't think it's just a rationalization that, you know, we do have this incredible, you know, I mean, this gets a little too intellectual, and I don't really want to go to that place except to say, you know, if you say, like we do in interpersonal neurobiology, that the mind is this self-organizational emergent process that is arising as energy and information flows, not just within the body, certainly not just in the skull, but throughout the body, but also as it's shared between people and among people and even with the planet. This sharing we call relational, and the thing through the body we call embodied. So this embodied relational process is self-organizing, and when you say that it's self-organizing, it means it's regulating energy and information flow. And when you say it's about energy, some people roll their eyes and they go, oh, yeah, now you're going to talk about quantum physics, or you're going to talk about whatever, you know, and they get kind of, you know, let's just talk about, I guess they want to talk about Newtonian mechanics or something about energy, but a lot of people don't even like to talk about energy. But when you really do, if you're willing to take that step, which I feel very deeply in terms of how I live this life, as well as what I see from a scientific point of view, is that energy moves through time by alterations in probability. It's a probability curve. And you can look at the physics and mathematics that's expressed in quantum theory, which looks at the way energy changes across time as changes in probability. And you go from 100% certainty where something is taken a possibility and it turns it into an actuality, or you move it down to zero certainty, which is 100% possibility. And, you know, we describe this, I talk about this in different books, you know, like the Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology goes into this a lot about this plane of possibility. And I do believe myself, how I feel, how I think, and what I experienced with my dad, is that when we're living this life, the energy patterns are continually dancing between, you know, fixed probabilities like a thought or a feeling or an image or something like that, which is the transformation of a possibility into an actuality. And then when I could see this in my father, you know, as his body was giving out, his mind was still present. The within mind was getting weak, but the between mind, between me and him, was really felt full. And I could feel that he was going to go from this dance between specific certainties to the world of infinite possibility. And, you know, however you want to interpret that, because everyone has a different background and a different narrative that is from where they come or how they see things. For me, whatever I would say about myself, I would say I'm totally a scientist at heart, but I see no separation between science and spirituality from what people have taught me spirituality as a word means, larger meaning, larger sense of connection. So as I'm sitting with my dad holding his, we're holding hands, you know, I'm feeling and thinking and knowing from a scientific point of view that this place that awaits us is this place of infinite possibility, that the energy curve will move into this open space, and that's where it is, and that's where we were before we conceived. So with that kind of feeling, I looked at my dad, you know, and told him I loved him. And we could be connected that way. Mm. And as I sit here now in this different space and time, you know, those manifestations of possibility into actuality that we call our life together, you know, those are things that don't really disappear. I mean, we may think time is just linear and, okay, you move along and that's gone. But there's a feeling in this whole view that things that exist have a kind of eternal imprint to them, that their manifestation as actualities from the plane of possibility creates an eternal imprint in the world. And I don't think this is a rationalization. I know when my dear friend John O'Donohue was alive, when he died suddenly as a young man, you know, but we used to talk a lot when we were working together on some projects on spirituality and poetry and the brain and all sorts of stuff like that. You know, this idea that, you know, we have to be careful of notions that time is simply linear, and that, you know, this narrative constriction of a self as only limited to the skin creates a kind of existential terror. And when you realize that the self is not bounded by the skin, it includes the skin for sure. We need to take care of our bodies. We should enjoy our bodies, you know, but there's a much larger self that is not just within, but it's between. Mm-hmm. And I guess in the passing of my father, all these issues, I'm just living them. You know, I'm not just, you know, not just thinking about them. I'm really just living them as present as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm moved to share something briefly from my own experience. My mom died so many years ago, and we had a really difficult relationship. And so many people who go through the grieving process are conflicted in ways that have to do with that. Like, you know, there's a sense of what I'm supposed to feel if my parent or someone that close to me dies, and then what if I don't feel that way? Or what if there's an emptiness where it seems like there should be some kind of flow of feeling? And in my circumstance, I went to go see my mom. She was really ill, and I flew back home, and I called her to check in, and she said, "When are you coming back?" And I said, "I'm not sure." And she said, "Well, you may miss my big trip." Mm. And that was the kind of thing she would never, ever say. And somebody who had spent time with the dying had told me that there's a prescience that also comes near the end. Mm-hmm. And that if I wanted to see my mom again, I should probably get right back on a plane and return. And I took that really seriously, and I did. I got right back on a plane, and there was a way that we couldn't really communicate very well, and we couldn't really bond. She wasn't available for that, I don't think, ever, out of her own pain and sorrow, a lot of it that she wasn't willing to touch. And when I went back the second time, she was a little bit out of it on medication, and I just arrived with a sense of gratitude for a possible last connection, and I wanted it to be really substantively different from what we knew together. And so I just sat next to her on the couch and I said, "Could I put my hand on your heart?" And she didn't really know exactly what I was saying or why I was saying it, but she said, "Okay," and I did. And I felt in just the 2 minutes or so that we had together a purity of connection and loving kindness and really attunement, coming back to that term from earlier. And it gave me such peace and gratitude to have had that moment with her, a moment so different from anyone that I'd ever had with her previously.
Wow.
And I went home that same night, and she died in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that I wanted to share that, because whether our connection with someone that we love so much is easy or profoundly difficult, self-attunement and attunement between in the moment of such momentous passages is still possible.
Oh, yeah.
It may look very, very different from person to person and from family to family, but whatever is there can still be met in the same way, and it doesn't need to look one particular way or another.
No, I totally agree, and thank you for sharing that. And I would say, and I'm kind of in a very raw moment now, so I don't feel I can talk too much about it at this moment, but, you know, I would say that the relationship I had with my father was profoundly, profoundly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm describing these last moments, and it is exactly as I'm describing it, but they were done with a long history of it not being like that.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and I agree. I think it's important we're sharing that. And, you know, it's a whole other issue, you know, the sorting through process when you lose someone with whom you had a very complex and difficult relationship, as it sounds like you had with your mom, and I certainly have had with my father. Although people often say to me, "Oh, my God, you write about all this stuff about attachment. You must have had a wonderful relationship with your parents," you know, and I go, "That's what you think, huh?" You know, like,
well, this series is called Teaching What We Need to Learn.
Yeah, so I totally agree. And, you know, the clarity of presence as an experience and a concept can really help you, you know, especially if you've had a difficult relationship with a caregiver or someone who, you know, is now dying, that, you know, you need to go, not you, but one needs to go deep inside and let resentment go, make sure things are said that need to be said, you know, as best they can. And, you know, I think we are narrative creatures, storytelling creatures, making sense of disruptions in a relationship and making sense of disappointments and disillusionments, you know, inside of ourselves. Sometimes it's a necessary place to start, so that we can, when we go to someone who's in a state of suffering and with whom we've had a very difficult relationship, you can let that be your own internal work and be as present as you can for however you feel it's meaningful for you to be present with that person, for sure.
Yeah. So just a couple of things before we close I'd love to just spend a few minutes on. One of them, coming back to the issue of attunement. In the work that I do, what I find is that most people who are hurting to some degree or don't feel fully or nearly fully self-actualized, they have a place inside of them, a constellation of feeling and belief that they're not able or willing yet to include in their attention, in their attunement. And usually this has something to do with shame. Often it has to do with trauma. But it's as if what they're saying as they progress on their personal and spiritual path is, I'll say yes to everything but that. That mm-hmm. doesn't get to be included.
Mm-hmm.
And that the healing power of attunement occurs when they finally say, okay, yes, it's been brought to me over and over, it's begged for my attention, and instead of saying, that's the thing that's wrong with me, that's the thing that doesn't belong, I'm going to say, it's okay now, you can come home, I'll let you be a part of me and a part of this as well. And I see that that decision makes all the difference for people, and that actually one of the most powerful things to share with them is that if they don't do that, if they keep saying no to that part of them that they like the least or want the least, then actually they're just re-wounding themselves in the same way that they were wounded through their own early development.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to share that because this powerful attunement that we've been talking about, I think, has the capacity to create healing and wholeness in an absolutely powerful way, an especially powerful way, when we turn it towards what has until this moment been just too hard to say yes to.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, astronomy, there's a parallel analogy of a black hole in the sky which has so much gravitational force, it sucks the photons, the light, out of the region near it, so when we look at it, it's black because there's no light emanating from it. And in the same way, when there's an item, a feeling, an experience, a relationship, something, which we cannot be open to, we can't attune to it, we say everything but that, that item is kind of like a black hole of the soul. It sucks the light and the vitality out of our minds. And when I say mind, I don't mean intellect. I mean heart, head, gut, everything. Relationships, that's the mind for me. It pulls the life out of the mind. And so a person feels like something isn't quite right. There's some hole inside of them, literally, this black hole of the soul. So that issue of there's one place in me I cannot go isn't just, oh, well, at least I got 99% of everything. You need to go to that place of hurt. So that attunement really is a kind of statement, if it could put words to it, it's like, bring it on. It's like, I am willing to be in any kind of internal or interpersonal space. And in the case of, if you've had a parent who's difficult, like we've been talking about, you say, listen, there's a part of me that knows it's difficult, but right now, I need to be here in this way that's good for me and good for this person. It's good for the whole experience of transition in the dying period. And I will be there. So it's not that you ignore the disappointments and the pain. It's that you embrace them and say, this is not the time to be actually talking about them with this person who's dying. Necessarily, you might think it is the time or whatever in a positive, constructive way. But usually it's not the time to work through things, in an acute and feisty kind of way. So this is exactly what you're talking about, that it's this bring it on state of receptivity to anything that arises, and you treat it with gentleness because ultimately this integrative process inside of making sense of being present for what is, of allowing the experiencing self to be differentiated from the observing self, but let them honor each other. This outcome of integration, when integration is made visible, it's kindness and compassion. Mm-hmm. And it's kindness toward the self and kindness toward others. And, one way of really embracing what kindness is, one way I like to define it is, it's honoring and supporting each other's vulnerability. Where you say, hey, we all have these tender places inside, places of hurt, places of need that are fulfilled, unfulfilled, ways in which we really depend on others and expose these needs to others, needs to be understood, needs to be connected to, needs to be held. So in all these ways, kindness then is a way you honor and support each other's vulnerability. And if we bring more kindness into the world, we'll actually bring more integration, which is also the root of health.
Mm. So compassion is integration made visible. I just wanted to say that back because it's so powerful and so moving to see it that way. And something else that comes to me from that, a lot of neuroscientists talk to us about the fictional sense of self, the idea that there is this autonomous I who is the author of one's own life. It seems like when we look for that, both spiritually and scientifically, we can't find it. There's a book called The User Illusion that refers to this. There's a book called The Mind's Past that speaks to this very specifically. Both of those books are more for lay people than for professionals. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because the more that we connect to one another and to what's around us and even connect within, it seems to me that there's, again, this great paradox where we start to let go of the idea that we are the doer, that we are the creators of our lives. And the more that we let life surge through us without trying to control it, the more actually we fulfill the uniqueness of our particular life form. And I see this over and over, both in myself and with others, the sense that when I let go into this process of attunement and integration that you've been sharing with us, it might seem at the surface like I'm going to surrender who I am and what I want and what I need, but in fact, I'm fulfilled and realized beyond my previous imagining. And so the self that I am is unique and personal and then also connected to everything that is, and the fullness there is just, In the truest sense of the word, awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this other gift I just wanted to bring into the conversation of what we've been talking about, that we get to switch from a much smaller perception of who we are, that, you know, skull-encapsulated being, as you were talking about, or the skin-encapsulated being, and to realize that even as we're living this life, until we go back to the place that your father returned to, that we still have the opportunity to be in the fullness of that kind of connection, to source ourselves not as the I, you know, who's interpreting this experience, but as the whole itself.
Yeah, I think it's beautifully said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, I it's a really interesting notion that there's a dance of deep connection between this observing capacity we have, which does have a narrative and does have a sense of free will and does have a sense of choice and purpose and links the past, present, and future in all sorts of ways. And so when you say people say they haven't found the self, I think there are many selves, and they have found certain relational aspects to that and certain, you know, neurological correlates. So they may not have found a single self, but there's certainly many, many of these circuits that underlie, for example, narration. We know a lot about that. And then there's experiencing. So this kind of strange tension between letting life surge through you, which is more like the experiencing circuit and letting it just kind of happen. And that's crucial, I think, for a full life. But there's also this observing, witnessing, narrating circuit that also has a life of its own, you know, kind of it is distinct. And it plays a really important role to say, hey, you know, how do I make moral decisions? How do I actually think about the purpose of life? How do I actually think about patterns that are me, in quotes, that maybe not so adaptive, not so healthy, that this narrating self in me wants to say, hey, there you go again on automatic pilot. Don't do that. That's actually you've learned over years of doing it that way. Maybe you want to try it a different way. So this ability to intentionally alter behaviors, alter patterns of how we focus attention, alter the way we become aware of things and even regulate our own feelings, even the way we process our own memories. This observing self has the capacity literally to change the structure and function of the brain with intention. And this is where I would say, yes, surging through life is good, letting life surge through you, that is, but also having this reflective ability to be aware and make choices that are informed and discerning choices. Like, for example, practicing a reflective few minutes each day is a really, really good thing to do. It's intentional. It's, you know, really moving between controlling what you're doing with your attention and letting things happen, if it's a mindfulness practice like that. And then when you do that, you say, okay, well, I am choosing to actually be disciplined about how to let my mind be spacious. I'm going to be disciplined about how to focus my attention inward, not just on technological gadgets or whatever. So there's a fantastic, you know, blend of both letting things happen, really, really, really important, and also being, you know, very aware and present in an observing way where you link the past, observations in the present, and plans for the future. And both those tracks, I think, are really important to
well,
the full life.
I love that addition, and it really kind of comes back to a central theme of our conversation today, because you spoke earlier about daydreaming with awareness and daydreaming without awareness, and
yeah.
How with awareness it brings so much to us, and without it's just spacing, you know.
Exactly.
And here in this situation, what I heard you say was that if you let life surge through you in the way that I described it, without observation, then again it would be just something's happening and then it's done happening. But if you let it happen and then you bring that kind of discerning, intentional awareness that you described, then it's the best of all possible worlds.
Exactly. And
yeah.
That's ideally whatever life presents us with. Loved ones dying, complicated relationships, surprising things that happen, the fate of our planet, the way we can really, I think, bring the best kind of healing and health to everyone, including our environment, is to cultivate these ways of blending experience and observation to be fully present and bring more compassion and kindness in the world, to bring positive healing movements of ourself and our connection with others into this world.
Mm. Well, I just want to say something by way of gratitude and in closing, which is that you are particularly unique because you have this deep understanding, and you also travel in very sophisticated intellectual and educational circles. You're a scholar, you're a doctor. There's a special facility that you have to both travel in those worlds and then to synthesize them, you know, into ways of expression that people can really get and put into their own lives. And yet, it seems to me, as I've just spent this hour with you, that your message and your gift is really actually most deeply present in who you are. And, you know, the concepts are brilliant and they're really helpful, but just the way that you approach the question of would you do the call today and what you've been willing to share just from your own heart and your own experience, it feels like everything that you teach is really present in a very palpable way in how you move in the world and how you connect with yourself and in this case with me, but also all the listeners. So I'm just so grateful that I got to have the personal experience to really add such deep dimension to all the great work that you do as well.
Well, Rafael, thank you very much. I mean, it's been you know, really powerful to connect with you today around all these things. And you know, thank you for the opportunity to explore these really really deep and important issues together and with anyone who's listening. So so thank you, and thank you for those beautiful words. You know, I think the only thing we can do in life is really try to live as you know, fully authentic and present and integrated as we can. And if in that journey, you know, we connect with others and it brings more kindness and compassion within our world, I think, I mean, what else can we do? So thanks for giving me this chance to be here with you.
You've been listening to Teaching What We Need to Learn, a unique online interview series in which leaders of personal growth and spirituality share their own innermost challenges. Two interviews are released each week during the series at teachingwhatweneedtolearn.com. That's also where you can send friends, family, and colleagues to sign up for the series, and I sincerely hope you will. We're also on Facebook as Teaching What We Need to Learn. The series producer is Julia Zaslow. Our chief technical officer is Kenneth Bushman. Our designer is Shannon Medisky, and our email management guru is Diana Pearson. Theme music is by Stephen Walters. You can find him at stephenwaltersmusic.com. A special thank you to our many volunteers and supporters, especially Bonnie McFarlane and Sandy Childs. I'm Raphael Kushner. You can learn more about my work and reach me personally at kushner.com. That's CUSHNIR.com. That's where you can learn about both my weekend workshop and week-long intensive at the Kripalu Yoga Center in Massachusetts from June 22nd to the 29th. Thank you again for joining me, and here's to vulnerable, powerful, transparent wisdom.